91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today we discuss the life and death of NFL superstar Junior Seau. His induction ceremony to the Pro Football Hall of Fame was conducted a few years after his suicide at age 43. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Seau was a perennial All-Pro, wildly popular with fans and players. The bulk of his career was spent with the Chargers in his hometown of San Diego. He played 3 years with the Miami Dolphins, then four more with New England. An autopsy showed Seau to have CTE, a degenerative disease caused by repetitive brain trauma, sometimes found in those who participate in violent sports. We'll speak with his biographer and friend, sports writer Jim Trotter. Stay tuned for Topical Currents after NPR and Regional News. And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents.
Hello, Joe.
Hello there.
Well, today we speak with ESPN's Jim Trotter. He's a former senior writer for Sports Illustrated and has covered the NFL for many years.
He also wrote for the San Diego Union-Tribune for 9 years, hence his knowledge about the late Hall of Fame linebacker Junior Seau, who played 20 years in the NFL. Trotter has published a book called Junior Seau, The Life and Death of a Football Icon.
And Jim Trotter joins us now via Skype from San Diego. Welcome to you. Pleasure to have you with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Tell us how you first met Junior Seau, and then just a little bit about your relationship with him.
It was 1996, and he was already a star linebacker for the San Diego Chargers. And I was working at the San Diego Union at the time, and I was reassigned to be the beat writer for the Chargers. And it was the off season. I walked into the locker room, and there were only two players in there, and Junior was one of them, and he was walking towards the training room, and he turned around and he saw me and called me over, and he introduced himself, which I thought was really strange because we all know who Junior Seau was. Mm. And he said, you know, you're the new guy. And I said, yeah, and introduced myself. And we talked for a moment. And he said, you know, look, if you ever need anything, you call me. Take my number. And I took his phone number down. And I actually thought it was a prank. And so I didn't use it. A couple of weeks later, I said, let me just see if this is real. And there was something that happened. I don't remember what it was. But I called the number. And I was expecting to get Domino's pizza or something like that. And it was Junior's voicemail. And he got back to me shortly after that. And I realized then that, you know, he was a genuine guy. And we just sort of formed a relationship from there where we came to trust each other from the standpoint that I knew he wasn't going to give me information or you know, confidential information about the team. But what he would do is that any time I, as a new NFL writer, needed to understand the culture of the NFL or the culture of, you know, a locker room or what a player's mentality is, you know, I could go to him and he would be honest with me about it. Or if I needed help, you know, learning something that maybe he didn't know, he could point me in the right direction. And, you know, to me, that was invaluable. And I think more than anything, it helped me get to the point that I'm at today.
When watching on TV, and of course we watched Junior Seau for almost 20 years, he seemed like such a magnet for the camera. He had such animated play and gestures. He was, well, I guess, about the closest thing to, say, Lawrence Taylor, and that's saying a lot.
Yeah, he was. He had, even off the field, he had a personality and he had a smile that was so infectious that, you know, when you met him, it didn't matter what your occupation was. It didn't matter what your income level was. He just made you feel like the most special person on the planet. You know, he would put his arm around you, and he called everyone buddy, you know, in part because sometimes he couldn't remember your name. But two, he just had this warm spirit about him. From a very young age, his mother always told, you know, Junior and his siblings, go out into the world and make happy. And that was something Junior, you know, loved to do. He was a people person. And, you know, he was very passionate about the youth of San Diego. And when he got on the field, he was very passionate about football. He was able to flip that switch and go from, you know, this engaging, warm guy to being this intense, ferocious player. And it didn't matter, you know, people knew his heart was always in the right place. And that's why whatever team he was with, whether it was Miami after he left San Diego, or whether it was New England following that, he immediately became a leader on those teams because players respected him and knew what he was about and that he was a genuine guy.
Let's talk about his youth, Jim Trotter. He really certainly didn't come from a ghetto situation, but it was a very hard scrabble life. You remarked in your book that he slept on the garage floor. He had a lot of siblings and hardworking parents of Samoan descent.
Oh, absolutely. He grew up in the eastern part of Oceanside, and for those who don't know, Oceanside, California is considered a military town. It borders on the south, Camp Pendleton, the largest Marine Corps base, you know, in California. And it was a tough area, and Junior, but it was tough, but it felt comfortable for Junior and many others because it was where one of the largest concentrations of Polynesians existed in the country. And so, you know, even though Junior didn't have a lot of money, his family didn't have a lot of money and those sorts of things, it was sort of that story where, you know, there was a lot of love. And yes, he and his brothers slept in the garage on mattresses on the floor, and the sisters had, you know, the bedroom, and the parents had a bedroom. But you know, whenever anyone would, his sisters would try and give him grief about it, like, you know, we have the bedroom and, you know, whatever, we have carpet, and Junior would turn around and turn a negative into a positive and say, yeah, but we have a bigger door than you do, meaning the garage door. He had a way of always trying to find the positive. But from a very young age, he exhibited tremendous athletic qualities, and his parents recognized that, in particular his father. And so, whereas typically in the Polynesian community, the kids would work to contribute to the family income, Junior's father said, no, let him play, because they realized that he had something special and that he could be that guy to help lift the family, you know, to another level. And, you know, the stories about Junior as a child and as an athlete are almost like, you know, urban legends where, you know, you talk to people who came behind him in the middle school. One of those was a person named Pulu Pameli, and he says when he got there, there were these stories about, you know, Junior playing softball during recess, and that he hit a ball so high that he was able to circle the bases, you know, all the bases before the ball ever came down. You know, it was just things like that, and you sort of laugh about it, and but then you hear other stories. But he was also an intense competitor. He tended to fight a lot. He was very emotional. And he would always say when there was one time his sister challenged him about it because he had embarrassed her with an outburst during a basketball game. And he said to her, you don't understand, you know, I have to be better than me, because he felt that if his teams lost, it was because he didn't play well enough or he didn't do enough. So he felt, you know, a great responsibility at a very young age.
Jim, did you ever ask yourself why he came to trust you the way he did, and why his family came to trust you to give you access to all of the material that you needed to write this book?
I think if I'm being 100% honest with you, you know, I think he and I developed a bond first and foremost because Junior always was conscious of his heritage. And so he always considered himself, you know, to use his words, a brother, you know, and I'm African American. And so, you know, he would always joke with me and quiz me about, do you know this song? You know, there'd be a song playing on there, and it'd be an old school song, and I would say, yeah, I know that song. And, yeah, well, who is it? Who is it? I'd have to tell him who it was, you know, who the singer was. And that was just, he just had this sort of old soul. And so I think that we related in terms of our backgrounds. We both came up, you know, a little bit hard or in situations that weren't ideal. And he kind of gravitated to me, and he developed a trust. And that's not to say we didn't have our issues. There was one time in particular where Junior always attended the off-season workouts and the voluntary mini camps. Didn't matter if it was voluntary or mandatory, he always attended. Well, there was one year he didn't attend, and some people were speculating that it was because he felt like the team had pulled a fast one on him in contract negotiations. And so I called him, his cell phone, I didn't get him. I called his house, I couldn't reach him. You know, I called some of those around him, no one knew where he was. And so in the meantime, the team was being very critical of him, going so far as to call him selfish. And I had to report it. You know, as a reporter, you have to report what the general manager and the coaches are saying.
Right.
And so the next time we saw each other, when he came back, he was livid. And, you know, I remember he called me hard copy. You know, I approached him to interview him about it. And he's, get out of here, hard copy. He was livid. And it took a little while before he would talk to me again. But this was typical of Junior. At the end of the year, he called all the media down to his restaurant for an off-the-record conversation, and he just wanted to mend fences because he had been difficult that year after what had happened. And we had a conversation, and I said to him, Junior, I said, I can't get inside of your head. And I said, I'm not paid to write what I think you're thinking. I said, I'm paid to write what you tell me you're thinking. And I said, when I call you and give you the opportunity to address a situation, if you don't return the call, there's nothing I can do in terms of presenting your side. And he took that to heart. And so whenever anything would happen in the future that might be somewhat, excuse me, controversial, when I would call or reach out, he would always get back to me. So he would learn from his mistakes, which is something that for me, showed a sign of maturity, because there are a lot of players who, once they feel like you've quote unquote burned them, mm-hmm. even if you haven't, they don't get over it. He looked at himself and learned from it.
Well, we're speaking with Jim Trotter. He's a journalist who covers the National Football League for ESPN, and he has written the book, Junior Seau, The Life and Death of a Football Icon. A short break on topical currents. When we come back, we'll let you get a drink of water, Jim. And when we come back, we'll also talk about how his family chose you to write this book. Stay with us.
And it is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We continue our discussion of football great, the late Junior Seau, with Jim Trotter of ESPN. We're talking about his book, Junior Seau, The Life and Death of a Football Icon. Jim, Bonnie broached the subject of why Junior's family so trusted you as well. And he had some contentious relationships there.
Yeah, I think they trusted me because he trusted me. But it wasn't easy. It took 2 years for them to finally open up, or at least talk about him publicly, because they had not done so prior to this. And, you know, it was interesting. When he passed away, I was working at Sports Illustrated at the time, and I wrote a piece about him. And immediately after it ran, book agents started calling and asking if I'd be interested in doing a book on Junior. And I said no. You know, I didn't want to intrude on the family's grief, and it was kind of personal. And then talking to people who were closest to him, as well as some family, they said that if anyone was going to write a book on him, he would want it to be me.
Jim, 1 second. We're having a little trouble with the Skype connection.
Okay. Let me know when you're there.
Okay.
You good?
Yeah, it's just kind of cutting out here and there. Let's see. Try it again.
Okay. I'm here now.
That's better.
Yeah, thank you.
Great. Well, they, you know, his family knew that I was close to him and that he trusted me. And when they said that if anyone was going to write a book about him, he would want it to be me, I decided to do it. And I decided to do it from the standpoint of not being a tell-all or a salacious book where I'm running down every woman he was ever with or every bar he was in. I wanted to really try and tell people what made him so beloved and so special to people. And then to try and examine some of the factors that may have contributed to him taking his life. And I think that his family and those close to him understood that I would be respectful in the process, and that I wasn't just writing a book to try and sell copies and be salacious. And that's the thing that I'm most proud of, is that, you know, his teammates, his closest friends, and hopefully his family feel that I did justice by being respectful of his children and his legacy, while at the same time telling a true story.
Jim Jr. Seau was certainly an icon of the San Diego Chargers, an icon of San Diego itself, similar to the way Don Shula and Dan Marino were here in Miami. Yet when he first went to San Diego, after he was drafted fifth in the first round, he had a very contentious beginning. Tell us about that when he came from USC.
Well, you know, Junior, remember, when he was young, as I said, he had a temper, and he would get into a lot of fights, and, you know, he'd be aggressive and all those sorts of things. And that played well for him in terms of, you know, being so competitive and that drive to win and be the best. But when he joined the Chargers fifth overall, he was ecstatic because he grew up in Oceanside in San Diego County. The Chargers were always his team. And even as a senior, his team played for a county championship, a section championship. And they played in Qualcomm Stadium, which was then San Diego Jack Murphy Stadium. And at that time, the Chargers trained there. And so their year-round locker room was there. Well, Junior went into the locker room, he and some friends, before a practice at the stadium. And, you know, the equipment manager, Sid Brooks, saw him and kind of called him out. And Junior told him, look, you know, we just love the Chargers and this, that, and the other. And there was Dan Fouts' helmet in his locker. And Junior said, can we touch it? And Sid Brooks allowed Junior to touch Dan Fouts' helmet. And so Junior went home dreaming of one day playing for the Chargers. And so when he got drafted by them, you know, he was ecstatic. But he also knew the realities of business. And he was so competitive that, one, he was upset to some degree that Keith McCants, a linebacker from Alabama, had been drafted one spot ahead of him, even though Junior thought he was the better player. And so when Keith McCants got his contract, Junior told the Chargers, I'm not signing for anything less than what Keith McCants got, even though Junior was drafted after him. And typically in the NFL, there is a slotting process. And so the player who is drafted higher typically gets more money. Well, the Chargers weren't going to pay him more than a player who was drafted ahead of him. And so Junior held out. And when he held out, fans got upset, and they called him greedy and all these other things. And it brought a lot of shame to the family because Junior's father got upset. And you have to remember, Junior's father, one of his mantras was always, honor thy family name, honor thy family name. So anytime Junior got into trouble, you know, his father felt that the family name had been dishonored. And so Junior felt shame and guilt about it. Well, in this case, the public got upset. They called Junior greedy. They booed him when he finally did sign his contract and played for the first time in Qualcomm Stadium. And his father was very hard on him again in terms of the silent treatment, telling him that, you know, he had dishonored the family name, that sort of thing. So it was a rough beginning for him. And the first year, he was fighting not only that, but the fact that the Chargers moved him from outside linebacker, where he could simply rush the passer, to inside linebacker. Well, now he had a lot of other responsibilities, and Junior didn't like the change, and he fought it for a while. So his rookie year was really an unhappy year for him, and he struggled.
Why did they move him?
Because they felt that he was so athletic that he could be more of a factor in the middle of the field, where he could get sideline to sideline, as opposed to being an outside linebacker on one side of the field where teams could run away from him. And so they wanted him to be more of a force on every play, as opposed to, you know, making it easy for offenses to scheme and block him, you know, and run away from him to the other side of the field.
The San Diego Chargers at that time and the first few years of his career were fairly mediocre. Describe his early years with the Chargers and when they finally began to get good and Junior really became more recognized.
Oh, yeah. After his rookie year in the offseason, Junior was home, and there was a knock at the door, and it was their linebackers coach. And you know, Junior's kind of wondering, well, what's he doing here? Because Junior's still upset about how his rookie year went and all of that. And the linebackers coach came to try and get him, to convince him that if you buy into what we're doing, you've got a chance to be a transcendent player, a really special player. You know, if you buy into the concept that you could be one of the greatest inside linebackers ever, as opposed to outside. And at first, Junior didn't want to hear it, you know, but he was respectful. And then he started to look inward and realize, you know, that he couldn't win that fight. And so once he started to buy in, you could see his play really take off. And second year, you know, he's going to the Pro Bowl. And he ends up going to 12 straight Pro Bowls. Well, he was having individual success, but the team was still struggling. And finally, in 92, before the 92 season, they changed coaches. They fired Dan Henning and they hired Bobby Ross. And, you know, Junior was a little skeptical because Bobby Ross had no NFL experience. You know, a couple of years earlier, he had shared a national championship at Georgia Tech, but he basically was a 500 coach in college. Now Bobby Ross comes to the Chargers, and they start out 0-4. And Junior and the other players are really questioning as to what's going on. Now, he would never say that publicly, but it's in one of the journals that I have that his family gave to me where he talks about, you know, sort of the unrest within the locker room that's starting to grow because they're 0-4 and everyone's upset and politics, he feels, are getting in the way in terms of who's playing and who isn't. But all of a sudden, the team takes off from there, and they win 11 of their final 12 games, and they go to the playoffs, and it appears to be the start of a great relationship. And 2 years after that, they go to a Super Bowl, even though they get routed by the 49ers. And it just appears that Junior, everything is coming together. You know, him as a player, the team and its success. But after that, as so often happens in the NFL, personalities start getting in the way. And from that point, over the rest of his career with the Chargers, they went to one playoff. And he struggled with that. He struggled with that a lot, even though he would never say it publicly, to the point that he started wearing his sweats backward. And one day one of his coaches asked him, why do you do that? Why are your sweats on backwards? And Junior said, because ever since we went to the Super Bowl, we've been going in the wrong direction, you know?
So what happened when you say personalities got in the way?
Bobby Ross felt that the general manager at that time, Bobby Beathard, wanted too much influence over who was playing and who wasn't. And Bobby Beathard would speak to assistant coaches about it. And Bobby Ross, you know, a former military man who believes in a chain of command, was very upset that the general manager would go to his assistant coaches and try and talk about who should be playing and who shouldn't. And it just created a very uncomfortable working relationship to where finally Bobby Ross resigned after the, I believe it was the 95 season. And you could say he resigned, but basically he was forced out. And the team from that point forward, at least the rest of Junior's career in San Diego, was never the same.
Sounds like you have a police dog there, Jim.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Why don't we take a break? This is Topical Currents. We're speaking with Jim Trotter about his book, Junior Seau, The Life and Death of a Football Icon. We'll take that short break and be back with more. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. And we resume our conversation with ESPN's Jim Trotter. We're talking about the late Hall of Fame NFL player, Junior Seau. Jim Trotter's book is called Junior Seau, The Life and Death of a Football Icon. Jim, we talked about the coaching change, Bobby Ross leaves, and then we get into, and I want you to touch briefly on the Ryan Leaf debacle and how that affected the Chargers and therefore Junior.
Well, the Chargers had been struggling, as I say, after Bobby Ross left, and they had been going through quarterback. Stan Humphries, who had helped them get to the Super Bowl, had retired because of repeated concussions. And so the Chargers needed a quarterback, you know, desperately. And so they had the third pick in the draft that year, and there were two quarterbacks who were considered franchise quarterbacks. One was Peyton Manning, and the other was Ryan Leaf. And so to ensure that they would get at least one of those two, they traded up from the third spot to the second spot. And after Indianapolis drafted Peyton Manning, the Chargers selected Ryan Leaf. And everyone was happy. They felt that, you know, they finally had a savior at quarterback. Well, Ryan had a reputation even in college of being very brash, very outspoken, belligerent at times. He wasn't necessarily a favorite of his teammates, but he produced on the field, which, you know, covered up a lot of issues. Well, he got to San Diego, and, you know, you'd have thought they were going to throw a parade for him. They were so happy to have him. Well, things didn't get off to a great start because in training camp, the veterans always have what they call a rookie initiation. And what happens is they take the rookies out to dinner, and the veterans buy up, you know, large meals and alcohol and that sort of thing. And then they make the rookies pay for it. And usually it's the highest draft pick who pays for it. Well, in this case, they got hold of Ryan's credit card and they charged it to his credit card. And Junior also charged a stadium suite to Ryan's credit card. Well, Ryan got very upset. And instead of confronting the players about it, he went to management. And so management then questioned Junior and the players about it. And the players felt that that was sort of a break of protocol, that you just don't do that. If you have an issue with a player, you take it to the player. You never go to management. Well, they get out on the practice field later, and Ryan throws an interception. And in practice, quarterbacks are not to be hit. They are not to be touched. They wear a different color jersey, usually a red jersey, which tells everyone this person is off limits. Well, Ryan threw the interception, and Junior, as the defense went down the field, turned and drilled Ryan Leaf along the sidelines. And everyone was stunned because what if he had hurt him? You know, you just don't touch the quarterback. And what it was Junior's way on behalf of the other players of letting Ryan know that there is a protocol among players and you don't violate it. And so a lot of people took that to mean that Junior was jealous of Ryan Leaf because Ryan was now stealing his attention. Ryan had now received the highest signing bonus in franchise history. You know, it was no longer Junior's team, quote unquote. It was Ryan's team. And people felt, there were outsiders who felt that Junior was jealous, which wasn't the case at all. Now we fast forward to the start of the season, and the Chargers start out 2-0. But Ryan doesn't play particularly well in either game. And we get to the third game, and the Chargers go to Kansas City, and Ryan Leaf winds up completing his first pass for 4 yards in a driving rainstorm and doesn't complete another pass the rest of the day. So he finishes 1 of 15, and he has more turnovers than he does passing yards in that game. It's just an awful game. And afterwards, there's a cameraman at his locker waiting, you know, for interviews to start. And the camera accidentally bumps Ryan as he's coming to his locker from the shower. And Ryan, you know, basically goes off on the guy a little bit. And the next day when it's written about, Ryan confronts the reporter in the locker room very irrationally, to the point that Junior has to step in between and lead Ryan away. So all of a sudden now the Chargers are realizing that this quarterback who they thought could be their savior is not that guy. And he's losing the locker room. And Junior, understanding the importance of that position to a team's success, decides, you know, I'm going to do what I can to help him. And so, for instance, when much of the team had turned on Ryan over the next couple of years and didn't talk to him and those sorts of things, Junior would be the one who would go to him and at least try and befriend him, even though Junior didn't respect him because Ryan was not a hard worker. And Ryan was not considered a tough guy. Junior would try and befriend him because he knew they needed to get something at the quarterback position. And so ultimately, what it did is it showed that, as Mike Riley told me, the head coach during part of that time in San Diego, that Junior was the guy who really tried to make it work, contrary to what people thought. But it was just that Ryan Leaf was not that guy that the franchise envisioned.
You know, we have, let's see, about 15 minutes left, and so I'd like to, we've talked a lot about his life, and I'd like to get to his problems now. Sure. He was riddled with problems. He was very troubled. When did that begin?
You know, that's what's interesting. I don't know that you can put a definite time stamp on when it began. I think you started to see things over the course of time. Mm-hmm. Now, I was never one of those guys who hung out with Junior away from the field. We had a relationship, but primarily when I saw him, it was, you know, after a game or at practice, or if his foundation was having a charity event, I would attend. And sometimes my daughters would come and help serve food, for instance, on Thanksgiving when he would close his restaurant and serve food to, you know, families of domestic violence or the military. So I didn't see a lot of these things that I learned about in researching the book. But what as I tried to piece it together, you could see late in his career, and particularly after his divorce in 2001, that he began drinking heavily. He began really partying, hanging out late, all those sorts of things, to the point that a friend and a former teammate got him to go to a 12-step program twice because Junior had said to him that he was losing himself, basically, that, you know, he was doing things that he didn't want to do and shouldn't do. And so there's that sort of says, okay, we can see what path he's on here. But then later, you also start to see that he's making bad and irrational decisions from a business standpoint. Now, this is a guy, when he opened his restaurant in 96, was so conservative with his money and so on point with it that he would stay up at training camp 1, 2, 3 in the morning reviewing the receipts from that day's business. He would have them faxed to his dorm room so that he could review them. And then later in life, he buys into a chain of Ruby Tuesday restaurants, 15 restaurants. And he not only buys in, but he guarantees the leases, which is something that you never do, and something that his advisors pleaded with him not to do, but he did it anyway. So you start to see a change in behavior there. And then later in his life, you start to hear from family and friends that his personality was changing, that one minute he would be happy-go-lucky Junior, and the next minute he would be sitting there with a blank, depressed look on his face. And then in the snap of a finger, he was back. Or he'd be playing golf, and he'd be happy-go-lucky. And the next, he'd be at the opposite end of the emotional spectrum, where he'd be angry and irrational and so intense that you start to get, you know, fearful for your safety. And then in the snap of fingers, he's back. So when you try and put all that together, it was over a course of, at least as I could see it, at least a few years, I would say 3-4 years, where it really started to manifest itself. And then you think about the gambling that, you know, his driver told me once he was in Vegas with him, and he went into the high roller room, and he sat down at the blackjack table by himself, and he played, I think it was 5 to 7 hands by himself, and he won $2.7 million in 20 minutes. And then he turned around and lost $1.5 million. You know, those sorts of things are just so rational.
Wait a second, Jim. We're having that kind of strange connection
just
again.
Went out a little bit.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, it's kind of breaking up a little again.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we're hearing you now. We're about due for a break. Why don't we take that break and maybe we can fix it on this end, if it's on this end.
Okay, we'll see what we can do.
Right,
we'll
back
be right
with you,
back.
Jim.
Stay with us. It's Topical Currents.
And we're back with today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and on the telephone, Jim Trotter. Are you there, Jim?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, very good. We've talked a lot about Junior's on-field actions and, of course, his off-field actions, but just adding up 20 years in the NFL of hits, 4 years of college, 4 years of high school, his autopsy showed he had CTE from repetitive head trauma.
I just want to say that means chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
I wanted you to say the big one.
Okay.
But it can never really be ascertained whether that was the cause or not, but it certainly had to figure in some way. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I think when you look at all of the symptoms of CTE, you know, he displayed all of them in terms of, you know, depression, forgetfulness, struggles with impulse control, irrational behavior, personality and mood swings. But, you know, the thing that struck me most, and this is the part where, after his death, I kind of kicked myself, was 2 months before he died, I had called him about the Saints Bounty scandal, which was just sort of flaring up. And I talked to him about it, just what the culture in the NFL is and if players really go out and try and with the intent of injuring an opponent. And then before we got off the phone, just as an aside, I just said to him, what do you think about what Roger Goodell is doing to the game? I said, people say he's making the game soft with, you know, his changes to, you know, the rules. And Junior said to me, and I'll read the quote, he said, it has to happen. And that kind of blew me away. And I said, what do you mean it has to happen? Because, again, we're talking to one of the all-time tough guys here in Junior Seau. And he said to me, he said, those who are saying the game is changing for the worse, well, they don't have a father who can't remember his name because of the game. He said, I'm pretty sure if everybody had to wake with their dad not knowing his name, not knowing his kids' names, not being able to function at a normal rate after football, they would understand that the game needs to change. If it doesn't, there are going to be more players, more great players, being affected by the things that we know of and aren't changing. That's not right. And at the time, I never thought to ask him, are you talking about yourself? Because, again, I hadn't been around him to see what he was going through. And when he died, that was the first quote that came back to me. And it was, he was talking about himself. And as I researched the book and you start piecing everything together, you could see, you know, in terms of the forgetfulness and not remembering names or dates or places, those sorts of things, he was clearly talking about himself. And it just, you know, it just gave me goosebumps, you know, because it helped me, or at least led me to believe that he was going through some very serious and deep issues.
Jim, will you talk about how he died for our listeners that don't know?
Yes, he shot himself in the chest. He went up into a guest bedroom in his beachfront home. His girlfriend had been staying with him. She was visiting from Texas at the time. She had gone to work out that morning. She left Junior behind. He was supposed to meet his father at the restaurant that morning. And when she came home, or when she left the gym, she called him to see where he was, and he didn't answer. So she went by the gym where he normally works out, and she looked in. She didn't see him, didn't see his car. So she went to the house. And when she got to the house and entered, she just said there was an eerie quiet, you know, that was very unusual. And she walked upstairs, and his dog was in the living room. And that was also very unusual. So she walked back to the bedroom, and he wasn't there. And she turned around to walk back down the hall. And all of a sudden, she noticed that the door to the guest bedroom, which is where his daughter normally stays, was shut. And that was unusual. And when she opened the door, she found his body. And, you know, a lot of people want to speculate and say that he shot himself in the heart, you know, to preserve his brain. I don't know that, so I can't say that. I don't know why he did it. There was no note left. There was no message left. And as one police officer said to me, the only person who's ever going to know why he did it is Junior himself.
His football career was over. He was estranged from his kids and his ex-wife. He had money troubles. He felt that his family treated him like an ATM. And then before the suicide, he drove his SUV off of a cliff. Could that have been intentional?
Could that have been a cry for help, actually?
Oh, absolutely. But you have to understand, Junior, that was a couple of years before, you know, the suicide. Junior, he's the kind of guy that when you went to him and you said, are you okay? You know, did you do this on purpose? What can I do? He would tell you, no, I fell asleep. You know, he was the guy who would never let you in to see his pain. Remember, as a player, early in his career, he would have the trainer come by his house in the morning, 5 a.m., whatever, and treat him before the trainer ever went to the facility because he didn't want teammates seeing him in the training room. At training camp, he would have the trainer come to his dorm room and treat him because he didn't want teammates ever seeing him in the training room. So now you're taught as an NFL player oftentimes that you don't show vulnerability and you don't show weakness. And then they leave the game, and for some of them, it's hard to flip that switch and say, okay, excuse me, now it's okay for me to show weakness. Now it's okay for me to ask for help. And in junior, he said he didn't do it on purpose. But, you know, what I found is that there are people very close to him, including his ex-wife and his uncle, who all believe that he did do it on purpose from this standpoint. After he went off the bluff, he was in the hospital, his inner circle's there, they're trying to figure out where he should stay because he can't go home because of the media. He ends up staying with his ex-wife. Well, every night they're having these deep, really raw conversations, 2, 3 in the morning. So after a couple of days, she says to him, look, we need to get some fresh air, let's go out. He doesn't want to go out, he doesn't want anyone to see him. She said, no, my windows are tinted, you can sit in the passenger seat, let's just go get some fresh air. And as they're driving, she's kind of going over what happened that day, that morning. And all of a sudden, they're driving closer to where it happened. And he starts to have an anxiety attack. And he's like, we got to get out of here. Let's go. Let's go. And so she drives away. And as she's driving away, she's piecing together all of the things that he's told her about that incident. And she's comparing that with what she has seen at the scene now. And she's realizing it doesn't add up. And so that night, she says to him, and she confronts him with a gentle hand, you can't do this. You have people who love you. I love you. Your kids love you. We need you. We can get help. You can't do this. And he says to her, I know I'm loved. I just don't know how to feel love anymore. And now you fast forward to roughly 6 months before he dies, and he and his daughter, Sydney, always had this special relationship, special bond, where when they would get off the phone or whatever, he would always say, you know I love you, right? And that was their thing. And they would always talk once a week or every other week. Well, he went off the grid, she said, for 4 months, and she couldn't reach him. And in the meantime, she had to write a paper, a school paper, a parent profile for one of her high school English classes. And she decides she's going to write it on her father. So she decides to list all of the issues she has with their relationship. And when she's done writing, it's 11 pages long. And she says, you know what, I'm going to put this in a letter, and I'm going to give it to him. So she texts him, and she says, be at your house on this day at this time. I'm coming over. I need to see you. And he's there. And instead of giving him the letter, she starts verbalizing it. And as she's doing so, she's crying, you know, just really emotional. And she's saying, why won't you let me help you? All I want to do is love you. I want you to be happy. I want to make you happy, all these things. And he's sitting there crying, but he's stoic, and he's looking right through her. And he says to her, I don't know how to feel love anymore. Mm. And the junior I know would never say that to his daughter, never.
Do you think, Jim, do you think that he would want the issues or the issue of chronic traumatic encephalopathy to be addressed?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think that's what he meant by that quote where he said, if there are things that we can do and we don't do it, that's wrong. And I think that's why he was in support of Roger Goodell and his enhanced player safety rules, because he realized what was happening to these players, including himself.
Well, do you think the NFL is doing enough?
I think it's improved. I don't know. That's a hard question because I don't know what enough is. It's,
right.
It's an inherently violent game, and you're never going to take head-to-head contact out of the game. I mean, every play, offensive and defensive linemen are butting heads. So how do you take that violent physical element out of the game? And, you know, I think the NFL has taken steps to try and improve player safety, but it's always going to be a violent game. And I just don't know that, short of not playing, I don't know what you can do to protect these guys fully.
Jim, give us your views on his election to the Hall of Fame and also the Hall of Fame induction controversy that was embroiled then.
Well, it's unfortunate because that was so blown out of proportion and so misrepresented. There were a lot of people that thought that the NFL was behind that and that they didn't want his daughter to speak for fear that she would use it as a platform to come down on the league and what it hasn't done regarding, you know, player safety and whatnot. And the truth of the matter is that had nothing to do with it. The Hall of Fame is an independent body. Now, the NFL is its biggest donator, but the NFL doesn't control policies at the Hall of Fame. And in fact, in 2011, the Hall of Fame came up with a new policy for presenters, and they decided that there would be no more presentations, formal presentations, at the induction ceremony. Instead, they would use video tributes. And they did that in part to satisfy TV, because the year before, the late Derek Thomas was inducted, and his presenter was Carl Peterson, the former GM of the Chiefs. And Carl spoke for 45 minutes presenting Derek Thomas. And television said, we can't have this. We can't put on a program with presenters speaking that long. So they came up with this new format that there would be only video presentations, and they would be 5 minutes long. Well, all of a sudden, the attorney for the Seau family starts looking for a conspiracy under every rock and is basically insinuating that it's the league in the hall trying to quiet Sidney, when in fact, and I know this for a fact because I had been in communication with the hall prior to this, they were always looking to allow her to speak at the gold jacket ceremony on Thursday night and then at the induction ceremony during the commercial break, which the network could have aired if it wanted. But they didn't want me to say anything to Sidney because they wanted it to be a surprise to her. So unfortunately, because of a lack of communication, a lot of things got blown out of proportion. A lot of things were misrepresented, and some very good people, you know, had their names sullied.
Where are we on the lawsuit that the Seau family has against the NFL?
We're still in the formative stages. And my hope, and this is selfishly speaking, my hope is that there is no settlement in this case and that we do go through, the family does go through the discovery process, because that's the one thing that has not happened, even with the settlement that the NFL reached in terms of the class action suit.
Right.
It did not go through discovery to where we found out what the NFL knew and when it knew it. And my hope, selfishly as a journalist, is that the Seau family sticks to its guns and says, you know, we're going to go through the discovery process, that we want to know what the NFL knew and when it knew it. And we not only want to know it, but we want every player and every family who's been affected by the game to know.
Well, Jim Trotter, a journalist who covers the National Football League for ESPN. He was a senior writer for Sports Illustrated for almost 7 years, and he's a member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame Selection Committee. The name of his book is Junior Seau, The Life and Death of a Football Icon. Jim, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I appreciate you having me.
Our pleasure.
Our producer today, Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Free audio archives available for download at our website, WLRN.org. Also, check out the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tune in tomorrow for a program featuring Overeaters Anonymous. The 12-step program gives help to compulsive overeaters and those with other eating disorders. We'll have some OA members on hand to tell their stories anonymously, of course. This is Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for listening today. Stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.